inviting me here to present this work. So this is sort of the collection of a set of papers written with David Fari, William Frost, and Matt Schwartz at Harvard. And my goal is to sort of give you an overview, sort of highlights of our first few papers, and then dive into some of the technical details of our latest paper with some new interesting results. Our story starts with the standard model and the discovery in 2012. So with this discovery, they established that the Higgs potential is this Mexican hat that we are also familiar with. And the question you should ask then is this the whole story? Specifically, what does it look like for large field values? And what determines this shape? So there are really two, let's go through the different scenarios. So three different cases you can consider. There's absolute stability, where we live over here in the true ground state. And there might be a minimum here, there might not be, but the lifetime is infinite. There's the metastability case, where we do not live in the ground state. We live in what we call a false vacuum. And the true vacuum is over here. But the tunneling rate is so slow that we haven't had time to tunnel over here yet. So the lifetime is longer than the age of the universe. And it's the instability scenario, where the lifetime is just shorter than the age of the universe. And if you're in this scenario, then you would have to say, well, I have to put in some new particles, because the standard model by itself doesn't make any sense. And by the way, I'm assuming standard model, like nothing else, even like beyond the Planck scale. It's just pure standard model. So what determines which of these scenarios you end up in? There are two competing effects. So the Higgs mass is one parameter, which is proportional to the quartic coupling lambda. And higher Higgs mass increases lambda. And my potential will be more stable the more positive term here. The other effect is the top mass. So the top mass is proportional to Yukawa. And in the loop corrections that I'll explain a little bit, that like comes into this potential, comes of the form negative sign because it's a fermion, and then the Yukawa to the fourth. So heavier top makes it more unstable. So these are two competing effects. And you can ask, so what's the phase diagram of this parameter space? Where are you stable, metastable, unstable? And people did these calculations back in the days, even before the Higgs was measured. Here's a paper from right after the Higgs, from 2013. And they mapped out for Higgs masses, top masses. So this green region here is your stable. The yellow sort of slop here is metastable. And this is instability. This non-perturbative regime just means that lambda became order one, and they don't trust results in that region. So you zoom in to exactly what the measured values were in 2013 with the error bars. And we see that we live in this metastable regime. And if you sort of look at the global sort of parameter space, if you like didn't know anything about any other masses, it seems very strange that we live in this sort of super narrow region. So it's peculiar. So we live in some very special place here. And if you go into the literature, people have like tried to like come up with models explaining this, but I'm not going to go into that. So our entryway into this field was we started looking at this potential. So the potential is really the 1 pi effective potential. And the observation that we were interested in was if you are in the gauge theory and you gauge fix and arc psi gauges, then these potentials explicitly depends on psi. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that, because you have your Lagrangian, you're used to having a psi floating around. And as long as you're calculating on-shell things, so like physical objects, then you know that the psi should drop out. Problem being that people were mostly just taking this potential, setting psi to their favorite value, and plotting it, and like trying to extract physical results. So we were wondering, can I say calculate something, say like the energy density of the true vacuum, using this potential, and like show that it's gauge invariant.
So do you think there was an error? I mean, psi, as you said, psi should have dropped out.
So the if you do the calculation, and you so we did the first calculation, and we show that it explicitly depends on psi, and that's just a signal that you're doing something wrong. So somehow you're doing something inconsistent, so you're either missing some diagrams, or you're doing something wrong. And what it turns out that's wrong is that for there to be another minimum appearing, I need my loop corrections, which is the thing that makes it turn over, to be the same size as my tree level, which is just growing. So my loop expansion is breaking down. So you have to come up with some new sort of consistent expansion. And in this case, you're just sort of counting lambda, which is a tree level thing. It's the same order as e to the 4, which is the leading coupling at one loop. So that's under expansion, just expanding in e. And let's see how this works to one loop level. So the one loop effect potential in just scalar QED looks something like this. There's lambda squared, there's a psi e squared lambda, and e to the 4. And here's this explicit psi that I was talking about. But if I now say, OK, let me count lambdas order e to the 4, then to order e to the 4, then this thing is gauge invariant. If you go to two loops, including two loop effects, so meaning like now I'm going to order e to the 6, then there are going to be two loop contributions coming in to cancel this e to the 6 contribution. So there's some like complicated cancellations happening, but we showed that you can do this in a gauge invariant way. And you have to include like an infinite set of these Dacey diagrams, which some of you might know from like finite temperature field theories. So this is just a highlight of our like two first papers. And the conclusion is, in this standard model, we calculated this absolute stability sort of boundary in a gauge invariant way. And numerically, it didn't change too much. I'll show you that in a second. So I'm going to tell you about what's called the absolute stability bound. So say you fix the top mass to be whatever you measured, central value. And then you go over here and you ask, what value does a Higgs mass have to be for me to be absolutely stable? That's what's called the absolute stability bound on the Higgs mass. So we did this calculation showing what this absolute stability bound was. For the old method, which was gauge dependent, and our new method, to see how big these effects were. So the one loop traditional method, which we can do with the explicit psi dependence, you can show that this point then drifts, and it's then sort of meaningless. And state of the art back in 2013 was going from one loop to two loops, so this tiny little difference. And with our new method, expanding in couplings of e, this is the leading order e to the 4. And this is e to the 6. So it's not a huge difference, but it's more important than whatever it was from one loop to two loops. So you can care whatever degree you want about these numbers, but at least now we know we have control of what we're doing. And this would work to any like order in coupling that we want to study. So this was the summary of first two papers. The next two papers, we started selling tunneling rates. So as you saw here, we now know this boundary between absolute stability and sort of instability. But where is the boundary here between instability and metastability? So how do you calculate tunneling rates? So first of all, this tunneling rates are physical, it should be gauge invariant. And the sort of standard reference that people will cite is Calvin Coleman, the fate of the false vacuum from 1977. And the starting point is calculating the path integral. So you calculate the path integral starting at some point x naught and then back to that point. And we have written it in sort of three different ways. And if we focus on the last one, if I ask what is the lowest energy state in the system, I can take, if I take the limit of this tau going to infinity, it's just going to pick out, the only thing that's going to be left is the lowest contribution here. So I can extract the lowest energy state, just taking the log and divided by t and take the limit. And if you're used to think about sort of instabilities in a sort of Bright-Wigner sort of way, you sort of say like, oh, if I have some instability, then this lowest energy state is going to have some imaginary part. So roughly, the decay rate is just the imaginary part of this object. And if you want to calculate this object, you take this formula and then use method of steepest descent. And these sort of stationary points are just, these instantons are just the stationary points of this integral. So here's our formula. What's the problem? If you look at this version, you see that this is, by definition, real. So what am I really saying when I'm saying take the imaginary part of this object? If you go read Cal and Coleman's paper, they have to do some sort of analytic continuation of this potential that they're studying. And they're only considering a case where your potential is not bounded from below. And whatever way they're doing it is not consistent if you sort of put in some bounded potential. So we were troubled by this. And we wrote a paper last year where we, using so it's a method of steepest descent, splitting up the contours, and we sort of we define a new way of specifying a complex path of your path integral, such that you get the actual tunneling, like the tunneling rate out. That, and the tunneling rate is just matches quantum mechanics, and that's the only reason why I sort of. The fact that when I do this, choosing this path and get quantum mechanics is the only sort of connection I have. I don't really know how to do that in field theory. So exactly why after this specific path is the thing that gives me the tunneling rate is unclear to us. So I won't be able to go into much more detail here, but I'll tell you a little quick story about an alternative way we found of driving tunneling rate such that I make the connection between like the tunneling rate and this formula more explicit. So let's consider this potential. So here I have my false vacuum, and here is some region which is sort of corresponding to the true vacuum for some potential x, and I'm just thinking of quantum mechanics here. And let me define the probability of being in the false vacuum as just this absolute square of the wave function. After some time t, integrated over this equation. So let's just do, so this is quantum mechanics, so I can just simulate it, just calculate it. So let's see if I can. Let's just look at this numerical solution of the Schrodinger equation for this specific potential. let's play it. See that sort of sloshing around here, and here's the probability of being in the false vacuum as it evolves with time. So it sort of seems like it's stabilized now. And then after a while, something funny happens. It starts bubbling up again. So let me pause it. So first, I'll show the video again. First, we saw that we started with some wave packet here. And I've multiplied this after this sort of turning point here. I've multiplied the wave function by like 50, so you can see it more clearly. So it's discontinuous. It's discontinuous right here. So I start with some wave packet, and it's going to sort of slosh around in here for a little bit. And every time it hits the wall, there's some probability that there's some probability it's going to leak out. And that's what you're sort of seeing here. But after a while, it sort of stabilizes. And then, meanwhile, this sort of wave has sort of propagated over here, bounced off this wall, and come back. And as this wave is sort of coming back, there's some probability of re-entering false vacuum. So that's what we're seeing here. Let's watch the video again. You can see all these features play out. So here's the sloshing around, dropping. And now the sort of probability leaking out is like rather stable for a long time. And now we can see this wave propagating back. And now it's re-entering, and then this is happening. OK, so what have we learned from this? We learned that if I want to ask about a tunneling rate, there's really, looking at the probability, there's only some sort of intermediate regime where it seems like it's sensible. If I ask about a tunneling rate over here, it's not constant over some time period, so it's not really sensible. It's also not sensible over here. So there's some intermediate time regime where it's longer than the sort of sloshing around in here timescale, but it's much shorter than bouncing off the far wall coming back. So there's some regime here that I'm going to care about.
So but how did you choose the initial wave function, and how sensitive are those results to that choice?
So here we just picked some Gaussian, but the potential is kind of tuned such that we get all these features in the same plot. Like if you pick a generic potential, like those time scales, I don't have any idea of how they scale. So we like played around with this potential until we got something that sort of illustrated our point. But I don't think it's very sensitive to the choice of a weight packet. Pick your favorite one and simulate it, and you'll see the same kind of feature.
But the time over which the features will appear changes depending on the weight packet. Do you know what it depends on?
So the time scale of just exiting just depends on the sort of oscillation frequency in this well.
So it's just the shape of the potential, not the shape of the
weight packet.
Or the weight packet.
I don't think the weight packet is important for that. Yeah, so if I want to talk about decay rate, which is, I think of something, some exponential decay of my probability, I want to be in some time scale between T slosh and what is called T nonlinear. And then knowing this probability, I can extract it using some formula like these. So if I want to have some rigorous sort of connection between like a tunneling rate, like I seem like I have to use these limits at some point. Yeah, so here's just the same plot we saw before. So I will not be able
to. What's the range of integration you have over x?
I think it's from in here.
Yeah.
I think it's from like minus infinity up to the Turing point. Sorry, the maximum of the potential. I don't think it's very sensitive to exactly where you cut it off. So, using this definition, starting with sort of physical intuition of what it should be, we wrote a paper again last year where we came up with a new formula for what the tunneling rate should be. And we started with the propagators. I want to start here, and I can sort of propagate out and then back, and including all different paths and taking these limits. And I'm sorry, this probably won't make that much sense, but I just sort of want to show you that we got a different formula. And this would be a whole separate talk explaining this. But at the end of the day,
are you expecting this whole slashing thing to happen in the field theory case too, or is this?
To some extent, but I don't have any like good control over what.
My intuition is going to be you're going to make a bubble and the bubble will go away, and it's really going to be rare to have the whole thing come backwards at you, right?
Yeah. So the coming backwards, that's going to be weird. Like, I'm not really considering that aspect of it, but the sort of whatever the initial time one is, I don't have an estimate for what that would be in the field theory case. But so my quantum mechanic intuition, which to whatever extent that extends to field theory, I'm not sure what more to say about that. But what I was going to say was that if you take this formula and then you expand to sort of quadratic order in these integrals, which is sort of the same thing that Coleman-Callan does, at the end of the day, you get back to the same result. So even though this doesn't make any sense, you can go read the paper, but there's some way of connecting. We have some other justification for Coleman's formula and why that thing should work in field theory. So.
Questions.
Oh, sorry, yes.
You can go first.
In the last slide,
yeah.
If I understand correctly, for deriving that formula, you used a Dirac delta function as an initial wave function? Because the propagator?
Yeah.
But does it make sense with the assumption you're making on the time scales? Because the Dirac delta function would propagate in zero time. And
sorry.
Looks like the T nonlinear would be very small.
So I think I can start with I'm not sure if the statement about which state I start with is that sensitive to it. But I think I can just yeah, I'm not sure if that's really, if it's that sensitive to that. I think it's an energy eigenstate and then propagate out. So we can discuss afterwards if you want.
What's a Stokes sigma?
Yeah, so so the sort of crucial point, there's a delta function here, which is a little bit awkward. But what it says is I'm only going to integrate over paths that, so in the quantum mechanics example, I start at, say, A, and then B is the turning, is the point where the energy is the same. So I'm only going to integrate over paths that cross B at some point. And this is the field theory equivalent of that. So there's some surface in field space. I'm only going to consider paths that cross that surface and sigmize that surface. So yeah, so that, this thing fires only if you pass it.
Do you know how does your computation compare to a WKB type of approximation?
So Coleman's formula matches WKB sort of by definition, and ours also matches WKB.
Not quite, actually. That's good. There's a thing that goes back to the 70s or 80s that if you specifically calculate the position-to-position amplitude at WKB, then you get, you know, the EDI action evaluated at a classical path where you specify the initial final position.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, say, prepared, if you actually ask the question, if I have a barrier and I start with a position eigenstate here and a position eigenstate here, do I tunnel? The answer is no, because if you're a position eigenstate, you have an overlap with all possible energies and some of them can go right over the barrier. So you always have a real-time path for that.
Okay.
The statement in the WKB approximation is that you just take, if you take any wave function and you can, and you multiply it by this position-to-position kernel, you can do the integral over the position at the one end. Again, in the WKB approximation, what it does is it turns the boundary condition at the end to a different one. So if you take an energy eigenstate, what it does is it takes, instead of taking the position-to-position boundary condition, you take a fixed energy-to-position boundary condition.
Okay.
Or if it's been a momentum eigenstate, you say, I specify the momentum there. That's what the WKB thing always does. And so then the tunneling statement would be, if I take an energy eigenstate inside the barrier and I ask for position outside the barrier, that's the thing that has a tunneling solution.
Okay.
And in practice, it's very much like Coleman's thing, because if you take a classical, if you take the ground state energy inside the barrier, that's basically classically sitting at the bottom. So it's almost like specifying a position.
Okay.
But it's not quite the right boundary condition if you do the WKB approximation. So yeah. That's kind of something which people have known for a long time, but I've never known any place where it actually mattered.
In fact,
Coleman gets it right.
Okay. Yeah. Did I answer your question? All right. So, in practice, if I want to evaluate either this version or Coleman's version, I want to find what's called the bound solutions. So it's just stationary points of an path integral. This is a stationary point, and I have some bounding conditions. And to linear approximation, just expanding to quadratic order, I get a Gaussian integral. So this thing factors out. This is the I'm normalizing by just sitting in the false vacuum. So this is just a Gaussian integral that's left. And one of these will have a negative eigenvalue. So when you take the square root, you get an imaginary part. This is a formula some of you might have seen before. So exactly how do you now evaluate these functional determinants? So you define your operator in some state phi j, and let phi j be some eigenfunction of this operator. And if you start with your field phi and you expand around the bounds under some normalization, that's we have an extra 2 pi here for convenience, such that when I do my Gaussian integral, the Gaussian integral just gives me 1 over the eigenvalue. And the functional determinant is just equal to the product of all of these eigenvalues. But there are infinite limit of them. So the first problem that appears is that I have 0 eigenvalues. So some of these lambdas are actually 0. So how do I see that? So let me guess that it's this sort of d mu phi over the bounds. And you can see that that is just equal to the derivative of S prime, which is by definition 0. So this has 0 eigenvalue, kind of corresponding to just translations. You can have a bubble being created anywhere in space-time. So the way you deal with this is that you re-express your your sort of set of complete functions with some translation invariance in it. There's some new zeta i's instead of the chi's we saw over here. And converting from one to the other, there's a Jacobian factor you have to take into account, which is equal to the normalization of the state, which happens to be just s over 2 pi. So the summary is, if I have a symmetry, what do I have to do? I have to somehow change coordinates, and there's a Jacobian that appears. And then I get an integral that's left over from integrating over the symmetry. In this case, it's translation, so it's just volume of space-time. So that's what happens if you have a symmetry. And at the end of the day, you then get some formula like this. So you have your Jacobian factor. You get 4 of the Jacobians because it's 3 space and 1 time. And then you now get a det prime, and prime means that I've removed the zero mode from this determinant. So let's look at a standard model. So you can roughly approximate it to just this d mu phi lambda phi to the 4. And in this theory, the bounds is this function. And the interesting observation is it's scale invariant, which you might know from these kind of 5-4 theories. And that's reflected in the fact that I have, in my solution, I have a free parameter. R can be anything. If I plug this phi into the action, it's independent of this R. So there's going to be a zero mode coming from the dilatation mode. There's just rescaling phi. So how do I deal with that? Well, we already know if I have a symmetry, I have to include some Jacobian factor changing my basis. And then I have to integrate over this direction in field space. So let's do that. If I calculate the normalization of this dilatation mode, it turns out that it's infinite. And so this dilatation mode that appears is not normalizable. So that's a little bit of a problem. There are really 3 problems that appears here. So this Jacobian is infinite. This mode that I've tried to expand around was not normalizable. Even if I didn't have that, and I tried to do my integral over R, I said it's scale invariant, so I have to add up over, I have to do sum over all sides of my bubbles, but they all give the same contribution. So it seems like this integral should just then be infinite. And also, if I tried to include the Higgs mass in here, it turns out this is a very slippery subject. If you try to include the mass, then somehow these solutions just kind of disappear. And exactly how to calculate like what the corrections are for sort of the correction from the mass is rather hard. So we addressed all these 3 problems in our paper. And so let's say, so this thing you can see from some sort of like variational approach. The integral over R is finite once you include quantum corrections from this running lambda. And this infinite Jacobian can be solved using a different kind of basis. And I'm only going to talk about this problem for this talk because you only have so much time. So the outline for the rest of the talk is that we're going to solve this Jacobian problem. And it turns out that we're going to choose a different basis for functional determinants. And the reason why this is interesting is that with this new basis, we can actually solve exactly for all the eigenvalues. We can get exact results for all these functional determinants. So I'm going to show you how to do that and how to exactly evaluate these functional determinants in 3 different ways. One is like sum of eigenvalues, and then we can go to a different like decomposition, decompose in terms of angular momentum. And then thirdly, I'm going to just tell you about this Gelfand-Janvold method, which is basically a way of turning the problem of I'm going to solve for these infinitely many eigenvalues into just solving one differential equation. It's a very powerful method. And once we've understood the technology here, we're going to apply that to standard model and evaluate that for scalars, vectors, and fermions. And then putting that all together and looking at what the lifetime of the standard model is.
So in this part, will you be using the quartic potential?
yeah.
the Higgs,
yeah.
rather than the corrected, quantum corrected potential, which will have the turnaround?
So in terms of calculating the tunneling rates, if you use the effective potential, then you've already integrated out the quantum fluctuations of the Higgs field. So what people have done in the past is that they take the 1 PI effective action, and then now I have some like new effective potential. Let me just solve for bound solutions in this potential. But it's not obvious that that gives you the right answer, because I've taken this sort of, the 1 PI effective potential is supposed to include all the quantum corrections for all my fields. But now I'm also saying I want to tunnel, like do a quantum thing on top of that again. So it's not clear that that's like the thing you should be doing. Maybe the thing you should be doing is integrating out all my other fields except for the Higgs. If that gives me some new potential, and then I should do that. But I think that's computationally very difficult. So what I'm doing is I'm just going to take lambda phi to the 4, so it's like approximation of the standard model, at some high energy scale where lambda has run negative. And I have, there's going to be like a relevant scale of like 10 to the 17. So I can, for the tunneling rate calculation, I can approximate it with lambda phi to the 4.
Sorry, did you say 10 to the 17?
Yeah.
What will happen to lambda, you said?
So lambda, if you run it for in the standard model, so this is mu. So it starts out some point one or something, and then at some point it goes negative, and then it goes positive again. The minimum here is at 10 to the 17.
So you will have a running lambda.
Is that again?
Will you have a running lambda?
I'm doing it fixed order. But the running of lambda comes into solving the problem of the integral over R that I sort of briefly mentioned before. So the integral over R is going to be infinite, sort of at fixed order, when I include loop corrections like through running lambda. So basically I can say that my tunneling rate, let me see over here, it's going to be e to the minus something like this. But I want this thing to be invariant under RG evolution. So there's some number here times log to whatever other scale you want, let's say R. So from RG evolution, there has to be some log that compensates for mu dependence of this. And this is the thing that comes in to solve the integral over R. But for this sake of my discussion now, like you can think of just dealing with this part and doing it fixed order.
So the modified behavior of lambda, the running portion, would that be an assumption or something you are deriving? I'm not following that part.
So this is actually what happens in the standard model.
Yeah.
And for and the fact that this runs negative is correlated with the fact that I have a fermion. So it's an assumption that I have a lambda that's negative at some point for it to be a tunneling
rate.
Just
some assumption. Okay.
But it's an assumption that is true in the standard model. So, all right, let's try and solve this. There's some more questions. Let's solve the Jacobian problem. So to remind you, the problem is that this phi d mode is non-normalizable. So I have in my functional, the ratio of functional determinants, there's an infinity in the denominator, and that does not exist in the numerator. And the way to solve this is we want to choose a different basis to evaluate my functional determinant. Let's go to the details. So I have my ratio of here that I'm normally interested in, just written out here in terms of box and potential. So let me just do the simple thing of factoring out the determinant of the potential here. I'm just left with this object. So this might, you might not see why this isn't a useful thing to do, but if I have factored out this, then my numerator and denominator, now the eigenfunctions of the numerator and denominator will now be the same, just eigenfunction over 1 over 3 lambda 5e box, and then the same thing for the numerator. And the eigenvalues are shifted by minus 1. So before, I had to find one solution to the box, and then one to box plus v little prime. So I've seemed like I've simplified my problem a lot. And this sort of observation was done by McCain, Wallace, and Drummond and Shore back in the 70s. The way they did it was that they realized they had this scale invariance, and then they mapped the problem to unit sphere in 5 dimensions. And because of the symmetries there, it was actually easier to solve the problem. And effectively, what they did was just this. Just that this is much easier to explain. And this is all you need to do. You just need to redefine your operator in this way. So one benefit of this is that, as I said, you have now the same eigenfunctions for both of them. But also, these eigenvalues are going to be dimensionless. Before, I had some eigenvalue that has dimension of mass squared. That's not necessarily a deal breaker, but this is definitely nicer. So point being, redefining my basis, which I can do. So before, I could only solve this thing numerically for most cases, unless it was very simple. Now, it's going to be a little bit technical. But I want to find, I can find exact solutions to this operator. So I'm going to basically do a expanding spherical harmonics. Here's the exact solution that you, again, you find it from going to, can go to the unit sphere in 5 dimensions. You can drive this. But so there's some spherical harmonics in 3 dimensions, plus some Legendre polynomial prefactor. And the eigenvalues just depend on n. And then there's some degeneracy factor that includes the number of modes of m, l, and s, which you might sort of similar to what you know from quantum mechanics, 3 dimensions. So now I have an exact solution to this, and I know all my eigenvalues, which is great. Huge improvement from before. You have to do it numerically. I can now, for n equal to 1, I have a 0 mode. And one of those, and if you calculate the number of modes, 0 modes I have for n equal to 1, it's going to be 5. It's going to be 2 times 3 cancels to 6, and then you have 5. One of them is going to be the dilatation mode, which I can now actually get a finite Jacobian. I get 4 translation modes as before. These are my 5 0 modes. So there's some Jacobian. And as I said before, now you get, so your tunneling rate is per unit volume. It's just equal to some Jacobian factor. The volume of space-time is canceled here. There's a 1 over vt before. And integral over this direction, this scale invariance direction. And the only thing I have left is to calculate the product of these eigenvalues, which I know exactly. So that sounds pretty doable. And I've removed the 0 mode here. Prime. So just for generality, let's just make some redefinitions. This will be helpful when we get to the standard model case. So I have, instead of writing s as box plus 3 lambda 5e, I'm going to define some m that depends on some parameter x. And so x equal to minus 1 is just the scalar case we considered before. And then similarly, I defined this ratio of determinants and my operator and my eigenfunction, eigenvalues. Okay. So if I want to calculate this ratio of determinants, I just take the log, and I can change this product over n to a sum. Sounds pretty doable. But as you will see, if you do this, you get a UV divergence. So as n goes to infinity, this thing actually blows up. All right. And the trick that turns out being just to solve this is I'm going to subtract and add the same infinity. I'll define what the infinity is in a minute. So I subtract some infinity, So I get this thing being finite. And then I can also calculate that same infinity using Feynman diagrams. And if you treat this x, you think of this x as like the perturbation. And it actually happens that if I extract infinity from the sum, it's all in these sort of x and x squared terms. So there's a quadratic divergence here, summing over n, it's linear here. And then it's going to be a log divergence from this piece. So I can do this step. I subtract this infinity, and I get something that's finite. And if you look up our paper, we have a closed form expression for that in terms of some weird functions. But it's closed form. That's pretty amazing. So I get some UE divergence, but I can subtract it to second order. It's all in the sort of one first and second order. So I can calculate this thing that's finite. So now let's look at this part. How do I calculate the same divergence using Feynman diagrams? So I want to include all Feynman diagrams up to order x squared. My Feynman rule is just going to be 3x lambda phi b, and this is in the Fourier transform of the bounds squared. So one diagram is just one insertion, but it turns out that that's going to be a scaleless integral, which in dimreg just gives you zero. The two insertions gives you some integral you can do, and you get 1 over epsilon in dimreg, ms bar, and some log, it's at your scales. Okay, and then putting it all together, I get that the ratio of determinants is just this finite answer I got from before, and these loops. And in here, I have a 1 over epsilon, so I have control over my infinity. And when you, that infinity, that this 1 over epsilon can then be canceled by counter terms in a normal way. OK, so let's now do the calculation in a slightly different order. And this is going to be useful for when we do the Gelfand-D'Angle method. So what did we do so far? We define these eigenfunctions, which is quantum numbers. And D is then just the product over all these eigenvalues to some power. And this degeneracy is just counting up all these M, L, and S states. So I just calculate the eigenvalues N, and I do the sum. That's what we just did. Now, let me decompose into angular momentum. So I'm going to focus on the S quantum number. So I want to basically have a definition that's something like this. I want to define R such that I want to calculate R. And S plus 1 is just the degeneracy over L and N. And in here, I want to explicitly have taken the sum over N already. So how do I do that? So R is going to be the ratio of these functional determinants, where I'm only going to take the product over, I'm going to take same eigenvalues. Now I just sum up over all the n's greater than s, according to this constraint. So you can do that, and you get some function. So I'm not sure if you can see it here, but this is a kappa x, and that's just a square root of 1 minus 24x. All right, we'll use this in a second. So again, this decomposition will be useful now. So now we're going to do this Gelfand-Yanglow method. So the point is to transform this eigenvalue problem into solving a differential equation. And this theorem says, if this is my operator, let me solve for the eigenfunction with zero eigenvalue. Take that function and take these limits. So I take the subscript 0 is for the denominator here, and subscript x is for the numerator. So I take this ratio as r goes to 0, and take the inverse ratio as r goes to infinity. The claim is that that will give you the product of all these eigenvalues. So that seems a little bit mysterious. So let's just do a quick example. Let's put in x equal to minus 1, which was the case, the sort of scalar case we considered before. If I set x to 0 here, I just have delta S phi equal to 0. And the solution is just r to the S. So it's pretty easy. Plug in x equal to minus 1. And then you can solve, just use Mathematica, you can find what the solution is to that equation. And if you plug in and into this formula, you get some answer. And this answer matches this answer. So the Gelfand-Yangilam method works. And it turns out that this method is very powerful, and it's going to help us a lot when we do the standard model. So what have we done so far? We have changed our basis so we can calculate exact eigenvalues. We know how to sum all the eigenvalues for an operator of this form. And we've also introduced this method of, instead of solving all the eigenvalues, we just solve the differential equation. So now let's use this technology we have developed to look at all these different cases that will be interesting for design models. I have real scalars, complex scalars, vectors, and fermions. All right, let's look at real scalars. This is just a case we've considered before with x equal to minus 1. For all these formulas I've given you now, I haven't actually subtracted the 0 eigenvalue. So n equal to 1 gave me 0 eigenvalue. As you can see, if you take this product, you get a log, which will blow up when x goes to minus 1. So I have to just subtract that from this function that I defined before. So I subtract the infinity, I add in the Jacobian, and using this formula I did not show you, but it's in our paper, you just get a closed form expression for what the racial determinant is in the standard model. It's quite simple. So don't worry too much about the numbers here. Okay, next scenario, complex scalars. So now I have some complex scalar, so I'm expanding around the bounds, and I have my Goldstone mode and my phi. I'm going to have two equations of motion, but that looks exactly like the cases we considered before, just now with x equal to minus 1 and x equal to minus 3. Let's just be able to substitute in. Now I have another zero mode from phase rotations here. And you have to take the appropriate Jacobian, integrate over the volume factor, and plug in the formulas for x equal to minus 3. It's also very simple. Now we get to the meat of the calculation paper, which is how do you deal with the vectors? So as you can see here just from the Lagrangian, this is going to be a lot more complicated. And I apologize in advance that this slide is going to be full of equations, but it shows you how complicated this is. So here are my equations of motion. So this is for every mu, so there are four equations here, and then there's one equation here for g. And if I want to now expand and do the angular momentum decomposition, or if I want to expand in terms of these spherical harmonics, in four dimensions, the way you do it is you define this function. So there's a scalar mode, this longitudinal mode, and a true transverse mode. This is a vector in four dimensions. Just do this decomposition. And this M sort of operator that I want to consider is not going to be a matrix. So here's the matrix. So the indices here is going to be scalar. So this is a 3x3 matrix. But the vector space here is going to be scalar, longitudinal, and the Goldstone. And this is the piece that has all the psi dependence, which is defined here. And the transverse modes factor out. And it's just equal to the scalar case again with some x. So that's easy to solve. We already know how to do that. So the question is, how do you find eigenfunctions using the Gelfand-Yangilam method for this complicated matrix? So to remind you, we want to find some, given some operator, we want to find something that has some eigenfunction with zero eigenvalue. So in this case, it's going to be three eigenfunctions with zero eigenvalue for this matrix which is scalar longitudinal in Goldsum mode. And the hatted operator is the one that is, has no interaction, so like x equals 0. And my R equivalent to this top formula is going to be just the product of the matrix of these three solutions, each of these three solutions, in the, with the appropriate limits. So if you're trying to solve this set of equations, it's pretty easy. You can do it in Mathematica. There's not too complicated expressions. And you calculate a determinant, and you get some pretty nice answer with some gauge dependence in it. But at the end of the day, I want to, when I put everything together, I want to make sure that this gauge dependence actually cancels. So to do the more general case, there was this paper by this group from Japan that had a very, very interesting observation. They were basically trying to solve a similar problem. And they noticed that if I take, given these matrices with a full gauge dependence, instead of, and I have this psi here, if I parameterize my psi in terms of three auxiliary functions, chi, eta, and zeta, in this particular way, then this, the zero eigenvalue, the zero eigenfunction equation, if I plug this in, it's just going to be simplified to this set of equations. So why is this nicer? So if you notice here that first equation only depends on zeta, second equation only depends on eta and zeta, and the top equation depends on all three. So somehow it's, this will end up being useful. And I should say, how did they end up with this set of equations? We contacted them, and I think it was just trial and failure. They did not know like a systematic way of getting this. They just like somehow magically found it. But if someone could figure out exactly like systematically how to do this for more general cases, that would be very interesting. OK, so let's see how this is going to help us. So I want to solve for three zero eigenvectors. Three eigenfunctions with zero eigenvalue. Let's solve for the first one. Let's set zeta eta equal to 0. So this is trivial. This is trivial. And the top equation, I just have delta s chi equal to 0. So we saw that before. That's just r to the s. Pretty simple. You take that, and you plug it into here, and you get your psi 1. OK, now let's do psi 2. Let me take zeta equal to 0, eta not equal to 0. So this is trivial. This equation now only depends on eta. So I can solve for eta. And then now I'm going to solve the top equation. If I try doing that just generically, I just don't know how to do it. So you have to make the following observation. There are two solutions to this top equation. There's a homogeneous part and a non-homogeneous part. The homogeneous part is just going to be the homogeneous part of chi. That's just going to be delta s chi equals 0. That's going to be the homogeneous part. And we know that that was already the solution for psi 1. So if I include the homogeneous part in psi 2, then psi 1 and psi 2 are going to be have a term that's linearly dependent on each other. So when I take the determinant, that thing's going to cancel. So I don't care about it. Let's repeat that. So there are going to be two solutions here, sort of the homogeneous and non-homogeneous solutions. And I don't care about the homogeneous part, because it's going to be linearly dependent to the psi 1. So it doesn't matter when I take the determinant. So I only care about the non-homogeneous solution to this. And you can find the limits of r going to infinity or r going to 0 by just sort of expanding the equation. So you can exactly solve for the limits of r going to 0 and r going to infinity for the non-homogeneous part, which is why this is so helpful. And similarly, psi 3, now I have to take both of these not equal to 0. But again, it's the same story. I don't care about the homogeneous solutions, because they're already going to be linearly dependent on these two other ones. So I can put put all this together, and I can calculate what the functional this functional determinant is. And it's some rather simple function, and the psi dependence that we saw before in these hatted solutions explicitly cancel. That's good. So we've shown that it's gauge invariant. That was actually, like, they have already showed that in this paper. You can calculate these things. I didn't have, yeah. So once you have this, now I have to do the sum over S, calculate the divergences for finite diagrams. But it's all the same as I sort of said before. So the last thing is to consider is fermions, which is basically the same story. You have your Lagrangian, you define some matrix, you use the Gelfand-Jangla method, and you get some nice closed form solution for what this ratio of operators is. And now we have to sum over j, and j here is half integer, so it's not listed as s. And again, you have to do the subtraction using Feynman diagrams. So summary of all my results. We changed the basis. We found exact solutions. We can do that in two ways. We could directly sum lambdas, or we can use the Gelfand-Jangla method. We calculated this now exactly for all different fields. And we calculated all the divergences and subtracted them using Feynman diagrams. So now we can turn to the standard model. So a standard model, I have my Higgs doublet, my W and B, and my kinetic terms, and I have my Yukawa couplings here for tops and bottoms. And putting it all together, now I will just have my decay rate. It's going to be the action valued on the bounce. And that has some volume factors and Jacobians here because of the zero modes. I'm going to have a functional determinant for each of the different sectors. I'm going to have the Higgs, the Z, W, top, bottom. And then there's an extra factor that I'm listing here, which comes from when you deal with the integral over R. I'm not explaining to you how to get to this part. But it turns out that it's not numerically important. So I'll show you that in a second. So you have to, like, do all these calculations. So we did using our exact formulas. And you can plug in all the numbers. And so the dominant effect is exponentially sensitive to what the action is. So that's some very, very small number. And there's some, yeah, some of them are big. Top contribution is pretty big. The bottom is roughly one. It doesn't really matter if the bottom is there for the tunneling rate. And then this factor that I did not tell you about, basically just have, like, order one. So it doesn't really matter. And with these exact formulas, we can do error analysis. So I can ask, putting it all together, my tunneling rate is 10 to the minus 683 GV cubed. And these are error bars, so upper and lower. So these are error bars from the top mass. So the top is the biggest uncertainty. You have uncertainty from the Higgs, large uncertainties from alpha S. There are large uncertainties from threshold corrections, and there's some estimates of NNLO corrections from scale variations. And if you add all these things together, you get the decay rates with error bars, which you can translate to a lifetime. So the final number for the lifetime of the standard model universe is 10 to the 139 plus 102 years minus 51 years. So seems like we're pretty safe. So if you now go back to these phase diagrams, now we have put in these lines for between metastability and instability. And but we are still situated here in this point, which is close to the absolute stability bound, but depending on what your error bars are. And the error bars on the line itself here come from alpha s, which are pretty large. So we produced a new set of plots, which I don't think I've seen before. It's instead of, so this is Higgs mass, top mass, we've produced alpha s top mass. And you can see what the three sigma sort of contours are in that space. And I think the relative uncertainty on alpha s now is larger than for the Higgs mass. So this is actually, like, maybe more interesting than these plots these days. So these are our final plots. And let me conclude. the standard model is metastable. We have developed a new method of calculating functional determinants with these rescaled operators. They gave us exact results with finite Jacobians. We solved that problem. The other results I've not described here are how to do the integral over R and how you estimate these corrections from the mass term in your Lagrangian. And you have now completed the first ever calculation of the standard model lifetime. And thank you for your attention.
Curious about this. How did you take into account that Lambda can do this in this calculation?
So, from doing the integral over R, there's going to be a specific mu that sort of sets the scale. There's going to be a mu that's dominating. And that's going to be, I basically want to maximize the decay rate. And that happens at mu, that is when mu is minimal, which is here, right? Beta lambda is equal to 0. So that's my scale. And then there's the correction from the integral over R. But I basically just set my scale where lambda is minimum. So that's where it comes in.
So if that's turns out to be very close to that scale.
Mm-hmm.
Should your calculations be changed somehow or not?
So if I put in any new particles, basically a lot of the story changes. So if I put in any scalar, I make my potential more positive. If I add in any fermion, it makes it more negative. So any sort of model building you do on top of the standard model can like drastically change the story, including like if you also, like whatever else happens at the Planck scale, can depending on exactly how you do it.
What does that mean? So you say that you're sensitive to Planck scale physics.
Well, if I there are two things I can do. I can let me sort of define add my normal lambda phi to the 4. Let me just add in say phi. The 6 over m Planck squared with a order 1 coefficient. So my sort of effective lambda now, if I just divide by 5 to 4, this thing is basically going to like kick off the potential here at the Planck scale. So this doesn't really change the value of the potential at the minimum. So the k rate doesn't really change much. So if I just add one positive operator, it basically doesn't change at all. If I do this, which people have considered, then I am creating a new minimum here. So if I add some new physics at the Planck scale or anywhere else, and I create a new vacuum somewhere, then my tunneling rate, then I have like two ways of tunneling. I can tunnel to this minimum or I can tunnel to this minimum. So I just have a different tunneling direction. And that tunneling rate can be arbitrarily large depending on exactly how you do this. So the statement is that if I ask about the tunneling rates, that is a UV sensitive object. If I create a new vacuum somewhere, that's the tunneling rate to that vacuum can always be large, or the tunneling rate can
always be large. Kind of intuitive, right? Because I'm thinking that if I want to vary, I'm not sure how the rest of that plot gets drawn, but I get into classically allowed regions way before I get to the point where I made my new minimum, right? So why isn't it just dominated by the getting through the barrier? Why do I have to tell?
So basically, if I create a bubble here, I have a smaller bubble with much lower energy inside. So they're sort of two different directions I tunnel to. They're not really related. But it's not like I could tunnel here and then tunnel here. It turns out this tunneling here directly can be much faster. And just like depending on the
faster, then why do you believe anything? I mean, if it really is true that I have to know what's going on at the Planck scale, then why isn't that just saying your theoretical error is as big as what you've calculated?
Well, I don't know, but depending on exactly what you think will happen to Planck scale, like, do you think you can create new minima? Like, do you think gravity?
Sounds like I have to care now.
Yeah.
So in that case, it sounds like that I have no information as to what's going to happen.
It's UV sensitive, so that's something you. But I don't quite know how you would sort of systematically do that without, like, you can do high dimensional operators, so you can sort of like parameterize it somehow, but I'm not sure if that can fully translate into like tell you something about gravity.
And just to make sure I'm understanding it, the issue is fields at the Planck size as opposed to energies at the Planck size. It's like,
yeah, it's
nowhere in that story is V over M Planck to the fourth anywhere near one. You're just saying that you've got a shallow potential.
It's a field value. So.
It gets large enough,
yeah,
which is what would be happening. Then it will change the story of the physics, clearly,
right,
as you get closer to Planck's cake.
I can certainly believe that's true.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of surprised that something physical cares.
Basically, like these sort of, I'm doing some sort of non-perturbative sort of path integral thing. Like it's not a normal sort of, I don't have a normal sort of effective field theory that I normally think about when I do collider physics. Like here I'm just in some new direction in field space that opens up.
So that's why I asked about field versus energy. Normally effective field theory, there's nothing a priori wrong about having a very large field in effective field theory, as long as you calculate what the energy is for those large fields reliably. Because you're really assuming that energy is small compared to whatever your cutoff was. And large field doesn't necessarily mean large energy. So that's what you said, is that the potential was never very large. But then it means you had to know what the potential was out at large scales. So you can be within an effective description. Someone has to tell you what the field, what the story is at large scales. And I know that traditionally we don't think about it because we imagine we're Taylor expanding our fields in powers of phi.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the principle, I guess? It sounds like there's, you're saying that...
I think the principle is you can only set... which way is it? You only set like one-sided bound on the lifetime. It can always be arbitrarily large. I can only set a lower bound on it.
Yeah. Can you remind me how big is the field at the minimum, at the usual minimum?
The usual minimum here is 10 to the 17.
So sorry, almost Planck size.
Yeah, normal Planck size. But this, the fact that I put in this at n Planck was arbitrary. If I put that in 2 n Planck or 100,000 n Planck, like if I just open up a new field direction, then like a Newtonian direction, then it would be the same story. So it is strange that this is close to the Planck scale, but the fact that it's UV sensitive is, it's not just because this is close to the Planck scale. This is going to closer to Planck scale.
I mean, if the Higgs can tunnel to such very large values, then the value of the Higgs potential is going to play the role of a very large cosmological, which means it will have to, the universe would want to collapse if you have a very large cosmological constant.
But he doesn't have a large one. He has one that actually is smaller than ours. Because
the value of the Higgs potential, V of phi, if phi is very large, it would play the role of a huge cosmological constant.
I think in his case, it's not huge, because he's saying it actually turns down and becomes small and large.
But small, small. Well,
negative, right?
It's negative, but really it's like
that's
lambda
that's
phi to the 4 at that scale, so
yeah.
This is large.
So because it is negative, it's going to tend to collapse the universe.
But now it becomes, I have to say, no offense, but it just becomes a just-so story now, right? It sounds like we're completely ignorant about the fields there, and so you can calculate in great detail what tunneling is. But if I can change it by changing what I did at the Planck scale, integrating something out and then changing the shape potential for large field values, it seems like then that was something which is equally likely to what you calculated. So that means that it's the real answer is we don't know what the tunneling rate is.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Well, you have to assume it is large enough so that the universe has existed up to now. So at least the physics has to be able to do that.
You're going
to
go on
Andromeda. What the future will be like.
Yeah.
In principle, right? So do we live in a metastable universe right now so that this sort of thing can happen? So if in principle, if it can happen, it can change all our views in cosmology.
But I had hoped that what we could learn from a calculation like this would have been something like, I make the assumption that there's nothing going on at very high energies, and in that case, I could learn something about, you know, that, so supposing you found that the K rate was fast, so we would not be here. Then we would have learned that there, whatever's going on, it's not a vacuum, or it's not the desert to the Planck scale. But it sounds like I can't even assume that, because if you'd found a fast lifetime, or maybe you can, maybe that would have been if your rate had been large, you would have believed it, because you couldn't have fixed that by having some other minimum.
Yeah. You can set a lower bound on it.
You can introduce new particles and lift the minimum, so it goes in either direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, yeah, so then what do we learn from the exercise?
I think the thing that sort of first is interesting about this is you just take the center model and you ask, what happens if I run out to the Planck scale? Like, where does it break?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't really break. Like, I don't have to, just by itself, it's fine after the Planck scale. And that's a little bit surprising. It doesn't really give us any new information on where to look. But that's an interesting observation by itself. And then you can say, any model building you do on top of that can change this in any direction. But
I guess we can thank the speaker and we can continue.